Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night when firewombles bleed. Truncheons and shields, you know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
How are we going with that time there, Pete? Oh, we're good now. Okay, cool. We got a huge show for you guys coming up. It is the 25th of May and this is episode 61. Huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Tom Palmer.
World famous
Tom Palmer, one of the big wigs at Cato Institute in the US. And you want to talk about heroes of liberty, like this guy, real hero of liberty. Stuff like smuggling Milton Friedman books into Eastern Europe. And I think he tells a story about a time he got arrested in
the
Soviet Union for bringing, what was it? Copyright.
Photocopiers.
I'm like, there's a copy in there.
Yeah. He used to smuggle photocopiers and fax machines.
Yeah, and I can't even smuggle it out of my own mouth. So
that's right. This is not media releases on tax reform. This is hardcore.
Yeah, and sort of shows you that me and Pete aren't exactly the heroes of liberty we think of ourselves sitting behind a microphone once a Friday. But anyway, so that's a really cool chat. We're also going to be talking to Jason Clemens from the Fraser Institute in Canada. He's one of the authors of this really cool new book, Demographics and Entrepreneurship, Mitigating the Effects of an Aging Population. It's got all over the world. It's talking about how new business entry rates are declining all over the world. Australia especially bad. We're going to get into it in a few stats pretty soon. But we're going to be talking to him about what the lessons from the book are and how they've found the numbers.
In collaboration with the IPA.
Yeah, we contributed to it as well with the Australian side of things. So we'll talk about it now. So we've already read out the book title. So it's the Fraser Institute in Canada, Center for Strategic International Studies in the US, the Adam Smith Institutes, the Entrepreneur Network in Britain, and us. So like all these think tanks from all over the world combining together. So here's the stats. So between 2003-05 and 2012-14, Australia had a 40% decline in new business entry rates, which is very bad in itself. And then you compare it to US was minus 20, Canada minus 15, and UK minus 4. So this is like a global phenomenon that new businesses aren't starting, and obviously that gives a lot of power to incumbent businesses, and that's not the greatest sign for an economy going forward. But Australia's got it really, really bad.
Mm-hmm. Worse than the other countries.
Yes.
That's that laser sharp analysis that people tune in for, James.
Yeah, absolutely. 40 is a bigger number than 20. You heard it from Peter Gregory first. Also, Australia's productivity growth is 49% slower in 2011 to 2015 compared to 1991 to 1995. So very problematic things coming forward from this book about the state of Australia's economy and state of it going forward. Mm-hmm. So looking forward to talking to Jason about what can be done to prevent the decline.
Yes.
So let's get into some other stories. So do we want to talk RID?
Yeah, let's do Peter RID. So as you may or may not be aware, Peter RID was censured by his employers, JCU in Queensland, for criticising his colleagues about the state of science on the Great Barrier Reef in the IPA's Climate Change the Facts 2017 book, and then later on Sky with Alan Jones. Subsequently, on the 2nd of May, he's actually been sacked by the university because he discussed that complaint publicly. He had been raising money to fight the legal battle. I was at $160,000, which he has achieved. So thank you to anyone who donated.
Also, in 3 days, which is really crazy. Like, people have really got around this story.
Well, it was advertised even internationally by, you know, climate change figures around the world. So he had a lot of support. He put $39,000 of his own pocket in, just in case you're wondering if he's contributing, which is obviously a huge amount for anyone. So all he did was what academics were meant to do. John Roskam said on the weekend in a media release that we released, JCU has shredded the
It'd
idea.
It'd be bad if we left that in drafts.
Yeah. Did we release that?
Oh, boy.
Obviously released. It got picked up a fair few places around Australia.
Definitely was released. JCU has shredded the idea that Australian universities have any sort of commitment to scientific inquiry and free academic inquiry. JCU's actions prove the depth of the crisis confronting Australia's university. The search for truth has been replaced by unquestioning allegiance to groupthink.
Yeah, well, he's exactly right. Like Peter RID says, you know, whether or not Peter RID is correct about the Great Barrier Reef thing, like surely it needs to be discussed.
It's so bizarre.
Especially when, I think we talked about this with Rowan Dean, if people want to go back through the archives and listen to the Rowan Dean interview. This is the kind of stuff where if it goes through unchallenged and if Peter RID turns out to be true and write about his criticisms of the Great Barrier Reef scientific thing, that's a huge boon for Australia's tourism industry, and it's going to change a lot of policies. Like, this is millions and millions of dollars we're talking about.
Yeah.
But because people don't want to engage in the argument,
they're gone.
It's if he's so stupid, right? If he's wrong, why can't his colleagues just point out the ways that he's wrong?
Exactly. It's the contest of ideas. Excuse me.
Do you want me to pad while you cough?
Thank you, yeah. The keen-eyed listener might notice that I'm pretty sick, and you're definitely going to notice that in the Tom Palmer interview, where every time I go to speak, I've got a frog in my throat. Am I a hero for still coming in and doing the podcast?
I'm going
to
say no.
I think it's up to the public to decide. I think we'll leave it to people. We'll have a Facebook poll. Okay. Is James a hero? Cool. We'll talk another story. So, obviously, this is something we've been talking about for a little bit, but the Tim Sunamasan, his time as Human Race Discrimination Commissioner, coming to an end. And unfortunately for our listeners out there, applications have closed. If you didn't get them off in time, I'm sorry.
53 people applied, apparently.
Really?
I thought more would apply.
I thought we should have applied. I didn't know there was an actual application process.
It's like 350 grand a year.
That is such a good job.
I know.
To go 350 grand a year to go around virtue signaling sounds like a pretty nice little earner. So we had a parliamentary research brief, which we sent to every politician in Australia, and it got picked up by news.com.au as well.
Morgan Begg.
By esteemed friend of the podcast, Morgan Begg. G'day, and recently married.
On his honeymoon.
On his honeymoon, he got like the media alerts. So he's talking about how we don't need a race discrimination commissioner. The role should be left vacant. So if you want to read more about that, that parliamentary research brief is on our website, and news.com.au obviously had the story, which we linked to in Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday? So just go back through your inbox and find that. I mean, obviously I agree with Morgan. It's like, what would happen to Australia if we didn't have someone that goes around asking people to complain under 18C over cartoons?
I don't know how we'd cope. That's the point.
What kind of cohesive society would we have?
That's the point. This position and the way it was conducted actually creates division rather than the opposite, which you think would be the purpose of it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously no one wants people racially discriminated against, but it's whether or not this role adds to the cohesion of society or only is present. And when you have someone in the office who, by all looks, wants to create that kind of headlines about racism in Australia, you just wonder if this is helping or hurting.
Well, and it's he promoted a highly contested version of what racial discrimination was.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Bill Leak cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, it's not my cup of tea, but obviously it's not racist.
Well, it's like, should we not talk about issues in
exactly, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
To me, that's a more racist thing.
Yeah, to say we're not talking about this at all.
Yeah.
okay, we've got one more story we're going to get to, and then we're going to go to our interviews. So this one, suddenly back in the news as well. So Tanya Plibersek has announced that a future ALP government would set a target of that 40% of chairs and deputy chair positions on government authorities will be women.
Yeah, so in the people sitting on them, not the chairs.
That's a good one there, Pete. And this was also co-signed by the ASX. So obviously the idea of gender quota is coming back into public consciousness. So you can read John Roskam sort of take this whole idea to task in the Australian Financial Review. That article's on our website. And this is a crazy thing of just like, I just remember in high school debating, we were told about like how gender quotas of like, they were talking about ideas that sound good, but the second you start to prick around them, you can start to see the problems. And gender quotas was the first topic. Like in high school, we were told like, well, it sounds good because women are there. But then obviously there's no respect to what they say because everyone sort of like gives the idea of like, oh, they're only there because they're a woman, and it's a tokenism kind of thing. And obviously and then it doesn't actually help anyone.
Yeah.
But now it's Labor policy.
That's right. It's actually they've had quotas for a while. Also, the ASX last week, which is part of what prompted John to write the article, said that they would like companies on the ASX to have quotas. Obviously there's a range of problems with them. They've done studies in Scandinavia. I think it's actually illegal for company boards to not. The company boards must have quotas, and they've found that it actually hasn't.
Helped.
Yeah, that's the word. It hasn't helped. Yeah. Like a lot of women who are talented and end up on boards end up being on like 17 boards because everyone needs to fill their quota, and it doesn't actually increase the number of women involved in business or anything like that.
Absolutely. And I also, I can't keep up with the talking points. So the idea behind these gender quotas, especially for companies, is a woman's perspective is needed at the top because it's going to inform decision-making in a company.
But surely the whole movement is that there's absolutely no difference between men and women. So is there a difference between how men and women think?
Yeah, well, that's...
I can't keep up with this.
That's it. Yeah, that implies that there is. Because as John says in the article, if women are meant to be good for business, then doesn't that mean that men and women are different?
Yeah, I think that's the...
Which is not implicit, like what I was taught.
Yeah, that's not the implicit way of thinking. All right, cool. So we're now going to interviews with Tom Palmer and Jason Clemens. But before we do, actually, I've got two events that you guys might out there want to attend. So if you are under the age of 25 and you are in Sydney or just in New South Wales in general, you can come along on June the 7th to the third debate in the series. I think it is Socialism v Capitalism, the Great Debate at the University of Sydney. That's being hosted by Generation Liberty. So yeah, June 7th. There's an event on Facebook through Generation Liberty. So if you haven't liked the page, like it now. And you can keep up with that event and all future events. And our good friends at the Samuel Griffith Society are going to be having their annual conference in Brisbane over the 3rd and the 5th of August. There's details and registration is now live on the Samuel Griffith Society website. And again, we linked to that in Hey Yesterday. So if you want to go to that, you can go there. Thank you guys so much for listening to the podcast. We are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. Make sure you guys are subscribed and make sure you guys are telling people around you that you think would enjoy the podcast. Get them inside. And if you are listening on iTunes, remember a 5-star review on iTunes really helps us out with the rankings. And Nina, where can people go if they want to take even more of a step to support the IPA?
Just visit our website at ipa.org.au and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you'll become a member of us. You'll receive invitations of our exclusive events, including the Generation Liberties events, and also free editions, free copies of our IPA reviews magazines.
Sounds very cool. All right, let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we are now joined on the show by Tom Palmer, Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute and Vice President for International Programs at the Atlas Network, two excellent organizations. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be with you and also to be in Australia.
Yeah, brilliant. So in case we have listeners who don't know you, Tom has been active in the promotion of libertarian and classical liberal ideas and policies since the early 1970s. He's been involved with spreading liberty in Eastern Europe and the Middle East at times when it was really, really needed, as well as edited and written many books such as Realizing Freedom, Libertarian Theory, History and Practice, The Morality of Capitalism, What Your Professors Won't Tell You, and After the Welfare State, Politicians Stole Your Future, You Can Get It Back. So let's get into it. You're here in Australia to speak at the Australian Libertarian Society's Freedom Conference. Can you give us a taste of what you're going to be talking about when you're there?
Well, actually, the first thing is I'm there to hear all the other talks as well. This is just a really great lineup, and I think very, very exciting program. I'm going to speak on a couple of different topics. One is a topic of a book I put out a couple of years ago called Self-Control or State Control. The alternative to having the state control us is us controlling ourselves, and that's something we can actually cultivate as the ability to manage our own lives. And then also a talk on the emerging threats to liberty, which is, I think, an important issue that we have to deal with, which is there are people who not only don't understand our ideas, but have thought about them and reject them. And there is, in fact, a global campaign against classical liberalism, an illiberal movement, much of it funded by the Kremlin, and we need to think about how to respond to that and to be able to defend liberty on moral grounds, on something beyond merely the efficiency or means and grounds that have typically been the territory that classical liberals have dominated.
Terrific. That sounds really interesting, Tom. Let's go right back to a bit earlier in your career. You're born in West Germany. You went to the United States as a child and then on to Oxford University. I think one of the most interesting sort of parts of your background is the period that you spent spreading the idea of liberty and libertarianism in Eastern Europe during communism and just after communism. For our listeners who might not know so much about that, do you mind explaining what you were doing and some of your best stories from that period?
Well, we have to remember what it was like in the 1970s and 1980s. It seemed that communism was just a feature of the world. There was a vast communist empire, and that wasn't going to go away, and there were free societies and communist societies standing in opposition to each other. And most people believed communism would just continue on indefinitely. I was not one of those people, and there were a few others who said, this system is going to collapse on its own. and we should do something about it. Now, there is a narrative that's very attractive, but happens to be false. And that's the idea that there was a big debate between free markets and communism lost the debate, and then it collapsed. This debate substantially did not happen. It's a myth that people like to tell about themselves to feel good. In fact, a better way to understand it is one side ran out of money and collapsed. They ran out of resources, and that was the end of the Soviet regime. It collapsed on its own. It didn't need a push from me or anybody else, quite frankly. But what mattered was what would replace it. And you could do worse than late, mature, communist, totalitarian societies. And we saw that in some of the countries to emerge out of the Soviet Union actually were worse. Think about Uzbekistan under Islam Karimov, Turkmenistan, the civil war in Tajikistan, over 100,000 people killed. So what mattered was that people not merely see the collapse of communism, but understand the institutions and ideas of free societies. So I moved to Austria and spent time traveling in the region, meeting people, trying to find people who were interested in these ideas, and then working with them to translate books, to get them published through illegal means, typically, samizdat, to get new books, textbooks in economics. I helped to organize conferences on everything from the rule of law, changing law school curriculum so that they could teach about property and contract and exchange, accounting. When the move came for some privatization, most state firms had no list of assets. What was it that you were going to privatize? No one knew what belonged to what. And so you needed to have an accounting foundation for movement into a market economy, as well as a legal foundation and lawyers and judges and so on. So that was what I focused on. I helped to found a number of organizations, some of which are still in existence, get the first non-Marxist textbooks in economics, Paul Haynes' very good book, The Economic Way of Thinking, into Russian, into Romanian, Hungarian, Albanian, and so on, to try to help people to make the shift from command societies based on totalitarian states and one-party rule into pluralistic democratic politics and constitutionalism, property, market economy, and the rule of law.
Right. That all sounds very worthwhile, and it's incredible to hear yourself put yourself at risk through that, like not only just the hours, but also the risk in doing some of this stuff illegally. But what was it really about the cause that really spoke to you when you were younger to just say, like, this is what I want to do with my life. This is the kind of risk that I'm willing to put myself to help these people.
Trying to think back over the course of my life of what actually motivated me, I have to remember that we tell stories about our past that change us as we get older. But I think that one thing that's been constant with me is it really hurts me when people suffer violence and brutality. I think I feel it more intimately maybe than some other people. And I can't stand the fact that there are people who are beaten and imprisoned because of their views or their religion or whatever it might happen to be, and identify with them. There's another feature in my life that I think I identified about myself a long time ago. Although I'm cautious about other people who are dangerous, I'm not really afraid of other people. And so doing those things seemed like a good opportunity for me because I wasn't particularly afraid of what would happen. As a fact, the risks that I ran were much smaller than those of the people in those countries doing things who had much more at stake. As a foreigner with a foreign passport, I might be arrested. I was arrested a number of times, and the worst thing that happens is generally they kick you out of the country. It wasn't like it had been in previous years. But that moved me to do this. It was my calling, and I'm glad that I did it. I made so many friendships with so many wonderful people of enormous courage and dignity and integrity. My life has been much better as a consequence. Now, I work today with partners throughout the Arab and Muslim worlds who also face, as we see in the newspaper, very serious threats from violent extremists. These people, many of them are very devout and pious in their religion. What they oppose is violence and coercion. And they are among the most brave and noble people I've ever known in my life, people in Afghanistan, in Syria, and other countries, who stand up for the values that we believe in, a strong libertarian ethic, idea of respect for other people. And they fight for those things every day. And I'm reminded every time I think about our friends in, let's say, Afghanistan, what they have suffered, what they experience, what they do to support these libertarian values. When I think of them, I'm reminded, how can I not be active when they never give up?
Tom, let's move on to that the work you're doing in the Middle East. What countries are you working in? What kind of activities are you doing? And do you find that there's a big appetite for liberty in that part of the world?
Well, I think that there is, and there is a growing group of writers, intellectuals, students, journalists, business people, and others who are willing to articulate clearly classical liberal ideas and stand up for them in public discourse. I don't do that much on the ground work, if you will, anymore. I work with partners throughout the Arab world, in Lebanon, for example, Lebanese Institute for Market Studies. I was there in Beirut and Tripoli and some other Lebanese cities a while ago, and they're doing brilliant work at trying to move Lebanon to a society that is a win-win or positive sum society and away from the zero-sum game that they've been stuck in. And they understand that the payoff can be quite high, because if they fail, they might end up in a Syrian-type horror. And they know that they need to do better. And so they have a number of very important initiatives, starting with a wedge issue, which is to privatize and create a competitive market in electricity. You might think, gosh, electricity, that's a shocking topic rest so much on. But the fact is, everybody knows they don't like the blackouts. And there is a solution to it, which is a competitive grid that allowed people to compete and produce electricity in the private market. For them, that's a wedge to get people to think differently about the country's future and to put them on the right path, and the opening for a number of other initiatives. We work with partners in Morocco and Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere. And in each case, they face their own kinds of policy questions and challenges to advance libertarian principles. And they do so with enormous adaptability, with the ability to understand what are the problems that they face and how to address their own populations. I admire those people enormously. And for those who would like to follow, who read Arabic, Minbar al-Hurriya, .org is a great reservoir of libertarian material in the Arab language. And there are similar initiatives in other languages in the region, in Turkish and Persian and so on.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I want to just, sorry, if we can just go back for a second. You mentioned that you'd been arrested numerous times in Eastern Europe when you were helping people out with these sort of things. And you said the worst thing that could happen to you with a foreign passport is basically be thrown out of the country. But were there any times that you were really worried for your own safety?
In communist countries, no. And just to be quite frank, and I wouldn't want to use the term numerous, which sounds much more dramatic, but there were a number of occasions when I was arrested or stopped. One of the things I did learn from my understanding of Austrian society and Austrian history is the importance of bureaucracy. Having a red stamp on a document was a very valuable thing to have. And so every official invitation that I received, I very carefully kept them and would wield them on occasions. So I remember once in Moscow, I was stopped, and I had two photocopying machines. And the question was, why are you coming into the country with two photocopying machines? This obviously illegal. And I said, I have an official invitation from the Academy of Sciences of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It's right here. It has a red stamp on it. I'm going to be delivering a course of lectures at Moscow State University, and I need to make notes for the students. They don't have photocopying machines and immediate access. How can I deliver my lectures if I cannot produce the notes for the students? I always travel with two photocopying machines. Who doesn't? And you just wear them down, and they finally just, they gave up. They said, okay, just go. I had similar occasions going into Czechoslovakia where I had brought 5,000 sheets of paper, a photocopying machine, and 100 copies of a photocopied samizdat or self-published version of The Road to Serfdom in the Czech language. I'd received from a friend a copy on rice paper. It's a very antiquated technology. He would make carbon copies. There were 8 copies of this translation of The Road to Serfdom. I took it back to Vienna. I went to a photocopy shop, made 100 copies. So now there are 108 copies. And I took them back. And I was pulled off the train, and they went through, what is this about? And I insisted, I have an official invitation from the Czech and Slovak Federal Socialist Republic Academy of Sciences to deliver these lectures, and Comrade Brúžek will be very disappointed if I'm further detained. And I demanded to see the station chief and the head of the security division at the border, and all of them spoke German, so I was able to argue with them and make the point, and they finally gave up, said, okay, just go. And the soldiers put all of my heavy things back onto the train, and although I don't speak Czech, I was quite confident they were saying, what the fuck is in these boxes, as they loaded them back on.
Terrific. Well, those are fantastic stories, Tom. We might end up with just one final question. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about liberty in the world at the moment? Has that changed in the last year or two? You mentioned earlier the Kremlin. What do you think about liberty in the world at the moment?
In general, I am optimistic for a couple of reasons. And actually, one is a kind of moral reason. Pessimism is likely to be self-fulfilling. We have a moral obligation to be optimistic. Optimists are more likely to win. We also look at the history of the post-war period up until the present, and in fact, if you look even longer in human history, there's so much good news. Steven Pinker's new book, Enlightenment Now, I think makes the case, his earlier book also on the better angels of our nature, that generally the human condition for most people, most of the time in most places, is getting better, and it's getting better because of the spread of the ideas of liberty, limited government, the rule of law, and so on. So and that thing means that there's reason to expect that that'll continue if we do our job, and we are more likely to do our job well if we're optimistic. Now, at the same time, there's an emerging movement of active illiberalism in the world. Much of it is heavily financed and encouraged by the Kremlin, but that's not the only source of it by any means. But illiberalism, I think, is growing. Ugly, hateful populism, disregard for principles of free trade, and we need to stand up to that and defend free, open, tolerant societies, to defend freedom of trade, to explain to people that is what produces prosperity and rising incomes and a better life for us and for our posterity. So the challenge has been laid down. I think we're up to it.
Brilliant. Tom Palmer, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, we are now joined by Jason Clemens, the Executive Vice President of the Fraser Institute and the President of the Fraser Institute Foundation. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. So, Jason, for obviously this is an Australian podcast and most of our listeners are from Australia. So do you mind telling us what the Fraser Institute is and what you guys focus on?
Sure. We're an independent economic research center based in Vancouver, Canada. And we focus on a host of public policies ranging from taxation to healthcare to education, Aboriginal issues, competitiveness, and our aim is to better educate Canadians and give them the information so that they can make better decisions about the public policies that govern them, with a particular eye towards improving our standard of living, both in the short term and in the longer term.
Excellent. So the latest book that we're talking about today is Demographics and Entrepreneurship, Mitigating the Effects of an Aging Population. Now, what were the key findings from this?
Sure. So there's really two parts of the book. The first part of the book really explains the problem that I just don't think most people are aware of. I mean, most people are aware that we have an aging population. Basically, it's driven by two things, that People are living longer, which is a great thing, obviously, but also that our fertility rates are declining, and so the average age is increasing in pretty well every industrialized country. However, what's missed in that is that the share of the population that is most predisposed to be successful entrepreneurs, which is basically people in their late 20s to their early to mid 40s, that age cohort is shrinking as a share of the population. It's already started to shrink, and over the next 20 years, we will see further shrinkage. And so the share of the population that actually has an ability to successfully be entrepreneurs will be smaller than it has been in the past. And so the rest of the book is then really talking about, given that we really can't do much about demographics, if anything, what can we do to improve the entrepreneurial environment and in strengthen the incentives for entrepreneurs so that of that shrinking cohort, we get more of them to be entrepreneurs and hopefully to be better entrepreneurs. And so the book goes through things like tax policy, regulatory policy, immigration rules, education, culture. It goes through a host of policy levers that countries can consider in terms of trying to improve the environment and the incentives faced by entrepreneurs.
That's really interesting, Jason. I've never heard that before, that sort of entrepreneurial sweet spot. Why is it that people in their late 20s to early 40s are more likely to be entrepreneurs?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's really two main explanations and then a couple minor explanations. So the two main explanations are that people in that age group are still willing to take risks. And if you just think about that, it makes intuitive sense, right? If you're 55 and you can see your retirement finish line, you're going to be much less willing to put financial capital and the health of your family, if you have one, on the line for a business interest. Now, it doesn't mean people in that age group don't do it. It means the tendency is much less than for that 29 to basically, again, early to mid 40s. So point one is they're more willing to take risks. And then point two is they tend to have business experience and some business skills. And so those two things combined, what we observe is that they have a much greater propensity to be successful entrepreneurs.
Cool. So in the book, we found that 40% of, Australia's had a 40% decline in small business startups between 2003-05 and 2012-14. Now, that's worse than the US at 20%, Canada at 15%, the UK at 4%. Why has Australia fallen so far behind?
Right. So one of the great strengths of the book and one of its weaknesses is that because we were trying to tell a general story across all the OECD countries or all the industrialized countries, with a particular focus on Australia, the UK, Canada, and the US, we weren't able to dive into the specifics of particular countries. So I would certainly look to our partners at IPA in Australia for more information from them on the specifics of what's happening in Australia. For us, what that chapter was about when we look at the decline in business startups is making the link that, yes, the population is aging. Yes, that share of the population that is predisposed to be successful entrepreneurs is shrinking. And so the theory is that we would see a decline in entrepreneurship. And so that the small business startup data that you just referred to is really about documenting that, in fact, Australia, the UK, Canada, and the US are in the middle of experiencing this decline in entrepreneurship. So it's not just theoretical. It actually is happening. Unfortunately, in terms of the specific explanation for why Australia has the decline, and of the four countries, it did have the largest decline. Unfortunately, I just don't have the specifics for that.
No, that's fine. So if our listeners do want to know more about that, I know Matthew Lesh here at the IPA has done a power of work about that problem. So if you do want to know about Australia's stuff, you can go through there. But let's talk about, so obviously there is a worldwide decline. So what is going to happen to these economies around the world and around the sort of West if this decline is allowed to continue and this fall in entrepreneurship is continuing?
Right. And this is the most important question. It's why we did the book, because it's not that it's going to happen. It's that it's already happening and it's going to continue to happen. And so if you look at the growth in living standards and in particular, and I apologize, it's a bit technical, but it's called multi-factor productivity. It's a fancy way of saying our ability to transfer inputs like labor and effort and ingenuity and raw materials into the things that we actually want. So an ability of a country or a province or state to take all those inputs and actually create the goods and services that people want. Our ability to do that is how we raise living standards. If we get better and more efficient at taking all those raw materials, labor and ingenuity and creativity and entrepreneurship, when we get better at that, of transitioning all that stuff into the things we want, the goods and services that we want, that's how we improve our living standard. And the problem is we now have almost 20 years of data, depending on your country, of a decline in our ability to improve transitioning from inputs into outputs. And a big reason for that, and the literature I think is very clear on that, a big reason for that is this decline in entrepreneurship. And so, you know, for the average Australian who's listening says, well, you know, how does it touch me or how does it affect me if entrepreneurship's in decline? What it means is that your standard of living is not going to grow at the rate that it otherwise would be. And so your kids are not going to be as well off as they otherwise would be. And you yourself over time won't be as well off as you otherwise would be, because we don't have the level of entrepreneurship that we used to. And entrepreneurship is key to discovering both new ways to do existing things better, but also to figure out and discover new products and services. And so it is at the heart of improving our living standard over time.
Jason, you mentioned there were some policy levers that were discussed in the book that might enhance entrepreneurship. What are some of those?
Sure. So one of them, one that I'm particularly interested in, is taxation. And there's really two aspects of the taxation issue. So personal income tax rates and then business taxes, and in particular capital gains taxes. The question being, to what extent do those taxes impede or even create barriers for people to be entrepreneurial, and or do they impede the financial capital that is the lifeblood for entrepreneurial ventures and business startups? And so countries looking at particularly higher income tax rates, that is tax rates that are actually faced by professionals and skilled labor and entrepreneurs and business owners, looking at those tax rates is going to be key. I actually think an inexpensive way that could really improve entrepreneurship is to eliminate capital gains taxes. That is, not reduce capital gains tax rates, but actually eliminate capital gains altogether. Most countries that have capital gains taxes don't raise all that much revenue. But two of our chapters talked about how capital gains taxes adversely affect the financing for entrepreneurs. So I think, I think eliminating capital gains taxes altogether is an excellent policy that can really improve entrepreneurship. And I would say Australia has a fairly high capital gains tax rate. So that's something that I can give you some specific information on Australia. A couple of the other chapters I think are important. Access to financial capital obviously is critical in terms of entrepreneurs actually being able to raise financing for the ventures that they want. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of banking laws in all the countries that we looked at that are really quite out of date in terms of how technology has evolved. They're really aimed at minimizing risk. And when you minimize risk, you're going to minimize the amount of capital that can flow to entrepreneurs. So I think looking at Australian banking and finance laws, particularly at laws that are starting to emerge on kind of the cutting edge of raising capital, I think those are key. And then I think another one that I would certainly mention is regulation. When we make it very costly and difficult to start a business and then run a business and then grow a business, we shouldn't be surprised if we get less of that activity. So I think there's an excellent chapter in the book that talks about regulatory reform. And then finally, only because it's an issue right now in Canada, I'm not sure about Australia, but certainly it's an issue in Canada. And it's a wonderful chapter by Deirdre McCloskey, who's an internationally recognized economist, and Art Carden, is a chapter about how society actually values entrepreneurship and enterprise. And their historical insight is that countries that positively value entrepreneurship and business and enterprise get more of that activity than countries who have an anti-business climate. And unfortunately, my home country of Canada, We've transitioned over the last 5 years to have a fairly anti-business climate right now. And it is, in my view, it is one of the contributing factors to Canada's decline in entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I know the IPA commissioned a poll showing that a lot of young people really wanted to one day start their own business. So that's a bit good. I suppose it's just the taxes that are getting in the way. Jason, thank you so much for joining us on the show. So once again, the book is Demographics and Entrepreneurship, Mitigating the Effects of an Aging Population. You can download that for free on the IPA website. And if that's not a bargain, I don't know what it is. So Jason, where else can people go if they want to support what's the Fraser Institute's doing and they want to learn more about this issue that's affecting the entire world?
At our website, www.fraserinstitute.org, as you say, the book and all the supporting materials, including the videos and the individual chapters, are all available there.
Cool. All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jason.
Okay, thank you too, Tom Palmer and Jason Clemens, for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So once again, you can download that book for free on our website, the one that we were talking about with Jason. So let's fly through some stories that have made us laugh this week. I would like to start with this one. So this got a lot of play around the internet over the last few days. So State Supreme Court Justice Don Greenwood ruled on Tuesday that Michael Rotondo must leave his parents' home in Camillus in upstate New York. So it's this 30-year-old guy. He was given marching orders by his parents.
With an impressive neck beard.
He had the world's greatest neck beard. Honestly, look up this story, see that neck beard, know what true neck beards look like.
He looks like a 30-year-old that lives with his mum.
It's definitely the mystique. Cool. So yeah, so his parents, so the parents, Christina and Mark, had been trying for months to get their son to move out. They even offered him money to help him find a place. Oh. He's like, I'm not leaving. They throw him out. He takes him to court, citing that they should have given him 6 months notice.
Okay. Which is not true. It's not a thing.
Yeah. Now the court originally, I think the first court they went to said you can't kick him out, and then the parents appealed it, and now like he does have to leave. But it's one of those ones where you're just like, if it comes to a court setting and you win and you get to stay at home, you've taken your parents to court. Do you really want to stay at home?
Why does he want to stay? He just doesn't want to pay rent.
I think he doesn't want to pay rent. It's truly bizarre story. Like everyone from the courtroom was having an absolute laugh, and the 30-year-old was interviewed, and all he's doing the entire interview is tying and retying his magnificent mane of hair, like down to his waist, and sort of playing with it. It's bizarre. Coming back to the idea of your parents need to give you 6 month notice to move out, I reckon when your parents wake you up and say happy 25th birthday, that's your 6 month notice.
What like is
that's,
it?
The clock is running from that point.
Firstly, as I said, I want to know why he wants to stay. And secondly, what did the first court say? Like, what was their argument? I know that you're a legal expert, James. But
well, you know, you think about all the precedent cases. No, I don't know. Like, obviously, this is the only one that came through. But yep. It did help that the guy just was happy to go on camera with the world's longest neck beard.
And we've got no actual sort of political uptake on this one, do we?
No, it's just a funny. Really funny story. And I mean, there's kind of a point of like the litigation of society now.
No, that's right. That's true.
Yeah. And the entitlement of millennials.
Lost boys.
Are millennials killing? What?
Lost boys. You know, they won't grow up.
I mean, there's a lot of issues here.
Yeah.
Maybe we should have had this at the start. This is good. We should have led the show with it.
We should have talked about it before we did it. Anyway, we've given people something to think about.
No, I do think there's nothing really to be made about this one other than check out this loser.
Yeah. Which makes us feel good. All right. Yes. So moving along to an issue which I know is very close to Nina's heart and she's very passionate about it. Straws have reared their...
Hold on. We don't have enough segments. We need to give this one a segment.
What?
If it's the straw thing?
Okay. I'll let James do this.
Peter Gregory is now about to give you the IPA, Young IPA Podcast, newest segment, Straw Man Arguments.
Okay. What's...
it away.
Okay. So, right. Straw Man Arguments.
Theme music pending.
Yeah. So if you've got any suggestions for theme music, send it in.
Yeah, song with the word straw in the title.
The straw man argument, the original straw man argument is obviously the straws. Nina's very passionate about this. We know. We told you a few months ago about a ban on straws in California that was underpinned by research by a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
A 9-year-old just did like a science project and came up with this figure that Americans turf 500 million straws a day, which was his name? Milo Kress. Milo Kress, the California 9-year-old. And he said he got that figure by calling 3 straw companies and then having a guesstimate. And on that basis, California Van Strauss.
That's more research than I did in 3 years of uni. Well, to be perfectly fair to Milo.
And it's a lot more research than a lot of government legislation gets based on, James, in Milo's defence. A further place has banned straws on the basis of this research. Vancouver, in the lovely country of Canada, just spoke to... Oh, we should have asked Jason about that.
Anyway, oh, that would have been good, yeah.
they have... What have they done? They said they're going to ban single-use straws from June 1, 2019. This is a really important step forward to demonstrate how serious we are in phasing out plastics and making sure we are working aggressively towards zero waste.
Mm-hmm.
Vancouver wants zero waste.
Yeah.
Zero.
Zero.
By 2040.
There's any waste. So this is now the third city that has had hospitality, like the hospitality industry has been brought to its knees by this 1 9-year-old kid. Just in case you'd thought you'd achieved anything with your life. Like, a 9-year-old kid has now affected three cities.
He's like 16 or 17 now. He actually did the project a few years ago.
And the other part is, like, overnight, New York, too, is really? Using this exact same study to... Okay, so on Wednesday, three Democrats on the City Council of New York, one from Brooklyn, Manhattan, one from Queens, introduced a bill that would prohibit restaurants, bars, and other food services from giving customers single-use plastic straws.
Okay.
Like, this kid now conquers New York.
And did they cite the figure? Because this figure was cited in the...
I don't know if they cited the figure, but obviously this, like, global, we need to get rid of straws for some reason movement is, like, there's the patient zero, and the patient zero is 9-year-old Milo.
Yeah, exactly right. So he came up with 500 million straws a day. Market analysts actually put the figure at 175 million. So not a million miles away.
But I would say enough of enough miles away to say that's probably a bit too much of a shot to the economy.
That's right. And
maybe some more research could have been done before governments legislate.
Anyway, what do you think, Nina? This is your issue.
I'd just say just don't brand the whole straw. Just get another kind of straw. Don't do the plastic straw then.
Oh, do you want loopy straws?
It is like, not.
They're fun. You know those straws that you go through like four loop-de-loops before it gets
here? There is the folded straw that you can put in as a key rings.
It's only one use straw. So wait. That straw's not banned.
What straw's on a key ring?
The folded one.
Yeah, we talked about it a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
All right, I blocked it out. That is... Who would have a straw on a key ring?
That's what you said last time.
I agree with me from 4 weeks ago.
Anyway.
All right, cool. I got another story here. So obviously a few weeks ago we were talking about how Melbourne taxpayers were going to be starting to fund the redevelopment of Etihad Stadium. The little stadium that could. And, the struggling entity, the AFL. Why do taxpayers need to fund anything?
It's outrageous.
But it came to light that Etihad Stadium were being sold to a new startup company. Very small, you might have heard of them, but obviously they didn't have the capital to redevelop the stadium on their own mind. On their own money, they really needed the help of the taxpayers. That company is Marvel.
Yep. Marvel.
Marvel.
Marvel, as in the Marvel?
Marvel is in Thor and, you know, four of the five biggest films of the last 20 years.
That's a startup company.
That's the tiny company.
Who doesn't have a capital to redevelop. Well, that's not...
Nina's
no, keep going, Nina.
They definitely have the capital to buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
But they just can't, they're pinching every penny.
Didn't sell it.
So they've just purchased naming rights.
They've purchased naming rights, but obviously, like... Etihad Stadium, Marvel has enough money to make it in. If they're putting in a Marvel store, they can also refurbish the ground a little, my point.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Or it's like maybe the government could have said, hey, if you want naming rights, you have to redevelop the stadium because we're not going to charge taxpayers to do this.
Yeah. If the AFL can attract international conglomerates, they don't need. Anyway.
Cool.
There you go, Marvel Stadium.
Yeah.
Sub-editor's dream. Every time Marvel someone plays stadium. Well, yeah. Superman.
Yeah.
Superhero.
Like, yeah, superhero. Iron Man in there.
Classic.
All right, cool.
Okay, so on to something else. We talked earlier about... What's that?
You good?
Yeah,
I was going to give you a ribbing, but then I thought better of it.
No, that's all right. So we were talking about the gender crisis before. A professor in the United States, University of Akron, near Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. Home of LeBron James?
Yes, the Cleveland, not this university.
No, Akron. Akron, like the small town.
Really?
So fun fact. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, he's actually from Cleveland.
That's literally the most interesting thing about this story. But
and then when he leaves this summer, oh boy.
There you go.
Turning his back on his hometown.
James likes American sports. There was an IT professor at the University of Akron called Li-Ping Lu who sent this email to his IT students. So he taught information computer science, something like that. FYI.
Something nerdy.
Something, yeah. I used to beat those kids up at school, so I don't know. No, just kidding. My dad's a computer programmer, and my mum. Literally both my parents.
You beat up your parents. No, that's huge.
Of course I didn't.
Oh my goodness. Worst son since Donald Green. No, the worst son since the guy that wouldn't move out of home until he's 30.
Well, not as bad as that. Anyway,
Tondo.
FYI, so he sent this email to his students. FYI, your grade has been sent to the university registrar. The following categories of students may see their grades raised one level or two. Following categories of students. Number one, female students. So, female students. And then in brackets, it is a national movement to encourage female students to go to information sciences.
Yeah, it's like, well, if you disagree with me, you are turning your back on the entire nation.
There you go. And categories two and three, which is kind of ho-hum stuff like...
But yeah, we led with a good one.
Number one is what we're talking about. So,
But what I like is that like he is so sure of himself in this that he is. It's not like the female is buried as like five or six on the. Yeah. It's like number one, female
categories of students, females. The university has subsequently told him he can't do that
because it's not right.
Yeah. What was your take, James?
We hit it on the head, like leading with the female thing. But again, it's the kind of thing like obviously in his mind, he's going like, well, I'm helping female enrollment. But what he's actually doing is saying, I don't think females are cut out for this class.
Yeah.
Females need this artificial way of boosting their grades because maybe they're too dumb enough to do computer sciences. Like that's what he's thinking. Which is the most sexist thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's all this stuff sexist. Mm. They said, he said, he pointed out that of their 450 students or something, only 60 or 70 were female.
Yeah.
Which is neither here nor there. Do you know what? I was reading...
It might just be a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't do computer science.
Yeah.
Anyway, I found out... Did you know girls do way better at school than boys?
Yes.
Yeah, that was...
That's for sure.
So
Nina, who has now been listening to us yammer back and forth for a year, can certainly attest that women are smarter than men.
Is 100% sure that that's true.
Listening to these two bozos wax lyrical about whatever comes to their mind.
Talking about?
If you want to hear what Nina thinks, tune into Indonesian Radio. What time's the show?
8.
And when are we coming on?
I don't know.
Oh, come on, Nina.
One day. You guys are busy anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of sport that needs
I'm
to be watched.
I'm doing the air quotation marks. All right, James, go.
It's actually up to you. You have a late addition to the show, something to do with line cutting.
Okay. So you might have seen this story, but this is what I call Australian democracy. A man, an intoxicated, one in brackets, intoxicated Brisbane man.
That's Australian democracy for you.
a landscaper. Gave the PM the finger at the in a Brisbane pub the other week because it was so one of these political at the pub events. The Prime Minister was there, went to get a beer at the bar, and this guy gave him the finger and gave him a torrent of abuse because he said that Turnbull cut in on him and went in front of him and pushed in front and got a froth before he did, which he apparently didn't. It sounded like he didn't really need at that point. The 27-year-old Karina man. Then got booted from the pub.
Yeah.
Can't
be throwing around abuse.
And then he got a $250 fine for refusing to leave a licensed venue. But it's so, and then he went on all the news outlets and said, well, the Prime Minister pushed in front of me. It subsequently emerged with footage that the Courier Mail obtained that the Prime Minister, the bar was pretty empty, and the Prime Minister went to a bar person. And this guy was like the other side of the bar, and he in no way could that be interpreted as him pushing in front.
Yeah, I think you have to give up, like, this person was ahead of me. I think it's a 1 meter radius on any side.
Yeah.
I think that should be the rule.
Yeah, and I think...
Maybe 2 meters.
And I think once it's crowded, your morals get left behind.
Oh, absolutely. It's every man for himself.
Yeah. So, I don't know what the upshot of all that is.
Well, I got one. Just funny. Is there... Has anyone ever been more uncomfortable than Turnbull getting accosted by a drunk man in a Brisbane pub? Like, that is Turnbull's vision of hell.
What is this man saying to me?
Yeah, he's... there's beer around instead of wine. It's a pub and not a nice little bar. And it's the regular public.
Well, that's true. He did have his... was it granddaughter or grandson... whilst drinking a beer at the footy once, and that was a bit of a controversy.
That was definitely a staged photo op.
Anyway.
Can you hand me that yellow liquid that you've got? Beer, is it?
Yeah. The people drink. And Sam Destiari asked where... So, he's a friend of the podcast. Asked where the free speech warriors were on this. Sam, here we are. We're standing up to this for this man's right to give the finger. He shouldn't have got a $250 fine, although that wasn't for giving the finger.
I'm not okay with him giving the finger. Like, there's...
We can be gentlemanly about it. You can just say, I was in front.
Yeah. But, I mean, anyway. But he's saying, and he didn't get the fine for giving the finger. He got the fine for refusing to leave.
Yeah, which is fair enough.
Who's not refused to leave may cast the first empty pot glass. Anyway, go, James.
Well, all right. I got one last thing. And obviously, this Sunday is a big day for one of the hosts of this podcast, Mr. Peter Gregory.
Me.
At 4:45 in the morning in... that's what I said. Like, AM is in the morning.
In the morning.
4:45 AM, the soccer team Liverpool will be taking on Real Madrid in Kiev in Ukraine.
Yep, Kiev.
Kiev in Ukraine.
According to my Ukrainian in the
Champions League grand final. Now, Pete's just come off a big grand final for himself with Melbourne Victory.
Yep.
And okay, so a plane's going down, right? And you can either save Liverpool, Melbourne Victory, or the Melbourne Demons. Who are we saving?
Well, Melbourne Demons are my first love.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Saving the D's?
Yep.
Okay. I was curious. But yeah, how do we feel?
About the game?
About Liverpool.
Well, it's, look, Real Madrid are a better side, and, they've got a more star-studded lineup, but Liverpool have
Ronaldo.
An incredible European heritage, as do Real Madrid now that I think about it. But you've got to be in it to win it. So what I'm saying is we're underdogs, but it's doable. And if we win, it'll be high scoring because we're not that good at defending, but we can knock them in for fun, James. So 6-5 is my prediction.
6-5?
Maybe 5-5 and I'll win on pens.
Wow.
Won a couple of Champions League finals on pens.
Yep. Will Salah score?
What's that, sorry?
Salah. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. I don't know. How to pronounce it, Salah. You get a few different...
I thought you said, I don't know if he scores. I'm like, obviously you don't know.
No, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
He's a superstar.
All right, well, good luck to Liverpool. Yeah, I'm also technically a Liverpool fan. I don't really watch a whole lot of games, but I'll play Liverpool when I play FIFA.
I've seen all these videos appearing on Facebook of drunk scousers on the planes and the buses and stuff.
They are Liverpool
fans. Singing... So it looks like so much fun.
Yeah, you're going to go over?
No.
You could look into it.
Yeah, I could, but I won't.
Okay, cool. All right, that's it for the show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you so much for subscribing. And thank you to Tom Palmer and Jason Clements for those interviews. If you are a fan of the podcast, make sure you're telling all your friends and family and people that you think would like the podcast about it and spread the word. If you are subscribed on iTunes, make sure you leave a 5-star review if you like the show. Also, you can have a comment. Maybe you could leave a tip. Maybe you could leave a Q&A clap for the next time we do that. And yeah, all right. And Nina, if people like what the IPA do around this podcast, and including this podcast probably, what can people do to take more of a active participation in what the IPA is doing?
Well, join as a member. Just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you'll become a member and you'll receive invitations, exclusive invitations or events, and also free copies of our IPA reviews.
Very cool. See you guys next week.
See ya.